From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The situation in Venezuela is tense, to say the least. After opposition leader Juan Guaido swore himself in as interim president on Wednesday, a number of world leaders rushed to recognize him, including those in the US, Canada, Brazil, and more. The actual president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, started his second six-year term only a few weeks ago. Maduro angrily denounced the US for backing a coup against his nation and issued ultimatums to US diplomats to leave Venezuela within 72 hours. He has good reason to fear U.S. intervention, given the history of Washington-backed coup attempts. But Maduro's rule has been rocked by weeks of mass protests, and it's a culmination of a crisis years in the making. Hyperinflation on the order of 1,000,000% has led to serious food shortages, and record numbers of Venezuelans have fled the country. So far, the Venezuelan military has backed Maduro's government. It is possible that opposition leader Guaido will conduct a parallel but powerless government that is recognized by some members of the international community while Maduro attempts to shore up his base. We turn now to our go-to guest on the issue of Venezuela, Miguel Tinker Salas. He's a professor of Latin American history and Chicano-Chicana Latino-Latina studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He's written a number of books, including The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela, as well as Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. He also co-edited Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. Welcome back to the program, Miguel.
Thank you very much.
So let's first talk about who Juan Guaido is. He's only 35 years old. Where does he get his power and backing? And what do you make of the fact that he has sworn himself in?
Well, he is a member of the National Assembly. The National Assembly is an opposition-controlled National Assembly, which was elected in December of 2015 and represented the first time in which the Chavista forces were actually defeated and did not have a majority in the National Assembly. There's been several leaders of the National Assembly, and he was selected a few weeks back. He is a delegate from the state of Vargas. His father is supposed to be an airline pilot, his mother a teacher. His grandfather was a member of the National Guard, I think a sergeant, and he belongs to Popular Will, Voluntad Popular, a party that was founded by Leopoldo López and others during the last 10 years with the intent of challenging then President Hugo Chavez and now challenging Nicolás Maduro. And again, he is not the leader of the opposition. He simply was the leader of the National Assembly that was selected a few weeks back. And his self-proclamation as president did not always go along with the entire sense of the National Assembly. There were some opposition members who did not want him to do that. They thought it was premature. So that sets the setting, the stage for the events that happened on January 23rd, which was this effort to, I believe, polarize the political situation in Venezuela and to eliminate any potential for dialogue, for negotiations between opposing parties.
So he declared himself interim president, and Mike Pence, the U.S. vice president, jumped in to recognize him. Canada has recognized him, and a number of regional powers in Latin America, Chile and Argentina, Peru, and most importantly, Brazil, which is the largest nation in Latin America. All of them have jumped in literally within 24 hours to say they recognize him as a new president. A person who just declared himself president and being recognized by some members of the international community just sounds pretty bizarre. I mean, no matter how bad the situation is in Venezuela, Maduro was elected, wasn't he?
He was elected, and this was very well orchestrated. This goes back several months, in fact, to the beginning of the 2018 period, when several Latin American conservative governments, those in Brazil, Argentina, and elsewhere, attempted to create what was called the Group of Lima, and that group sought to delegitimate Maduro's presidency. That group sought to have sanctions imposed on Maduro and on Venezuela. And that's the group that immediately recognized Maduro. It is Bolsonaro in Brazil, a neo-fascist president in Brazil. It is Macri in Argentina, Sebastián Piñera in Chile, Duque in Colombia. Of all places, Juan Orlando Hernández in Honduras, a person who many people in Honduras considered an illegitimate president. And even the advisors who were there observing the elections thought that the election was rigged. Jimmy Morales in Guatemala. So it's a very interesting cabal of countries that have immediately jumped in to legitimate Mr. Guaido, along with Donald Trump. And taking it a step further, last November, John Bolton, National Security Advisor, his statement was the U.S. would do everything in its power to bring down what he called the Troika of Tyranny. Remember, this is the before we had the Axis of Evil as the war in Iraq built up. Now we have the Troika of Tyranny in which Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba are targeted for a regime change. And in many ways, this is part of that process. This is the greater fear many people have, because as Donald Trump said clearly on the 23rd of January, he said, all options are on the table. When he was asked, is there a military option? He once again repeated, all options are on the table.
Wow. So generally speaking, historically speaking, at least, it has been the Venezuelan military that has shifted the balance of power toward one or other regime, hasn't it? And so far, the Venezuelan military is with Maduro, which may be the one last bulwark in his presidency?
Yes and no. The military has universally, at least the military officer corps, has universally supported Maduro. But there is also support among the population. On the 23rd, we had, in fact, dueling protest. The problem in the U.S. is we only saw the opposition's protest. It is as if the other one didn't exist. That doesn't mean that everyone was out supporting Maduro. They were, in fact, out supporting a political process. There are many on the left who are critical of Maduro for incompetence, for a whole series of economic mismanagement, but they still support the very social changes that have been promised by the Bolivarian context. So in that sense, it's important to understand that there is support for a process, even though many people have been very critical of Maduro. And again, what I think part of what the Guaido self-proclamation and the U.S. An endorsement is to see if there is fissures within the military, to see if there are cracks within the military, to see what they can exploit. So far, they have not found any. But it's obvious that part of this process by Guaido has been to, one, consolidate the opposition that up until a few weeks ago was essentially prostrated, distraught, unable to mobilize, and unable to rally forces. At the second time, it is to polarize conditions in Venezuela, remove dialogue as an option, and then third, see if there are fissures or fractures within the military.
So let's actually pause to examine what Maduro has done to sort of arrive at this place. There is this tremendous international pressure from Western states to oust him and oust the last remnants of the Chavez government. But he, as you and I have talked over several years, has unfortunately not been the most effective president. The inflationary rate, economic inflation in particular, I understand, has been the biggest problem. How much of that responsibility lies with Maduro?
Inflation is over 1,000,000%, the highest in the world. Now, this is unprecedented. That means that your paycheck essentially dissolves before you even have a chance to buy products. An example of it is that Maduro, on his inauguration, made it by edict, increased salaries to 18,000 bolivares a day. Well, guess what? The next minute, the price of cheese, the price of meat, the price of chicken, all had gone up to compensate for that. And the reality is that that's part of the problem. So yes, Venezuela depends on oil. Oil prices have collapsed. So, but part of the problem is that the PDVSA, the national oil company, is producing less. Why is it producing less? Two factors. One, they haven't invested in the infrastructure. They haven't invested in the very industry that is the goose that lays the golden egg. So they haven't invested in oil. Second, the price of oil has gone down. And third, they are really focused on the development of heavy crude deposits in the Orinoco Basin. Heavy crude deposits require more cost in production, more cost in refining, and they also require importing light crude, in some cases from Algeria, but sometimes from the U.S., in order to mix with heavy crude in order to be able to create the light substance that can be sold internationally. So already Venezuela has increased cost in the very production of the crude that it has to export. That's one set of the problems. The other is the country has always been a net importer of basic food products. In 1935, when the country became the leading exporter of oil in the world, it also became a net importer of food. That is, a significant part of what Venezuelans consume, they have to import. That means that they take oil earnings and they import finished products, food products and others from a variety of markets, traditionally the U.S. Later, it was the countries of South America. Now, alternative markets are being sought after as well. So that means that the price, the amount of money available to import products is also limited. So that those are all causing and pushing the inflation. You add to that, as I said before, economic improvisation, mismanagement, corruption, and you begin to see the context for this crisis, and that's what's creating these conditions. And the last part of this is the sanctions. The U.S. under Obama imposed sanctions. Those sanctions have been ratcheted up by the Trump administration, and those sanctions mean that the country cannot acquire credit on the international markets, and it cannot buy products on the international markets that are needed to, in fact, modernize its own very oil industry. So those factors together are all what is exacerbating the crisis as well.
Now, I understand that a tremendous, record-breaking number of Venezuelans in recent years have fled the country, something like 3 million people, many of them going to neighboring Brazil. In fact, that population now even faces expulsion from Brazil. That, too, has, I understand, been a pretty strong marker of the crisis facing Venezuela, right?
Undoubtedly, over 3 million people have left, primarily to Colombia, however. To Colombia, to Ecuador, Peru, and some have gone to Brazil, but they've been dispersed everywhere now. Venezuela used to be a country that attracted immigrants. It attracted Syrians, it attracted Iraqis, it attracted South Americans during the crisis in South America. It attracted Europeans, thousands of Europeans, and attracted Trinidadians and Haitians, and now it is expelling populations. And those individuals are leaving primarily because their standard of living has declined. They can't find employment, the shortages of food, the shortages of medicine. And that speaks to the nature and the extent of this crisis, which the government has not been able to resolve.
So, Miguel, right now, Maduro has decided to cut off ties with the U.S., political and diplomatic ties. He's given diplomats 72 hours to leave the country. And he has accused the U.S. of backing a coup. And of course, he's done that quite a lot because the U.S. has very often interfered in Venezuela's government. But Venezuela doesn't have much leverage over the U.S., does it? I mean, even though it exports oil to the United States, the U.S. doesn't need Venezuelan oil as much as it used to, does it?
No, it doesn't. In fact, as we know, Venezuelan crude is heavy crude, and therefore, it's not necessarily a product that is as desirable. There are certain refineries in the U.S., in Houston and elsewhere in the Gulf, that are created to refine Venezuelan crude, but the U.S. could easily tomorrow shut off the importation of Venezuelan oil. But then again, there is China, and China has been increasing its purchases of Venezuelan oil. Many of them are barter credit swaps for oil, in which the country pays for the credit based upon delivery of oil. India has also been buying Venezuelan oil. Oil is also sold regionally throughout smaller markets. But yes, obviously, if the U.S. did not buy Venezuelan oil, it would be a dramatic impact immediately on the economy and on the sense of the impending crisis that might generate. On the other hand, this is exactly what the Trump administration with Bolton and and Pompeo wanted. They wanted to put Maduro up against the wall to create a condition in which he had to respond, and he does. If he did not respond, he would essentially lose support among his own base. He cannot allow, no president would allow an alternative president to pretend to create an alternative government and to be another sovereign within the country. That's simply not something that a president can afford to do and maintain legitimacy. Likewise, Maduro has now boxed himself in because he's given the diplomats 72 hours to leave. And if they don't leave, and if they try to arrest them and deport them, that will also escalate the crisis. But that's precisely, I think, what the Trump administration has wanted. And this is what they've been attempting to do in order to create a crisis situation in the country that they can then exacerbate further have pretext. And people fear is a pretext for intervention.
So Juan Guaido is also expecting to be arrested, isn't he? I mean, I imagine that that's what he is going for, putting himself up as a martyr that people can rally around.
Precisely. I think that this has been part of a strategy. As I said, it's no mere coincidence that Guaido declares himself a president, self-declares himself a president, and then all of a sudden all these foreign governments simply seek to legitimate him within hours, minutes, as soon as he has pronounced himself. So I think this is part of an international strategy that seeks not to to allow Maduro to consolidate power and to begin his next six-year term. There is, as I said, an effort to seek regime change that I would be clear. It was sought by Bush, it was sought by Obama, and is now being pursued ardently by Trump.
And of course, what's quite different now compared to under Obama is that, as you said earlier, you have this regional set of governments that have tilted rightward. The pendulum, unfortunately, has swung back rightward in Latin America in some countries. They seem to be coordinating actions, with Venezuela being their latest target. Are there other countries, are there countries like Cuba and others that remain on Maduro's side and can protect Maduro politically?
I don't know if protect it would be the word I would use. I don't think Cuba has the capacity to protect Venezuela as such. What I think is the most important development is that Mexico, which was part of the Group of Lima, no longer is part of the group. It has not signed any of the declarations, and it has said it will continue to recognize Maduro. The same goes for Uruguay, that has said it will continue to recognize Maduro. And both Mexico and Uruguay, along with Spain and Portugal, have offered their services to, in fact, negotiate, mediate differences in Venezuela, hoping to avoid a further escalation of the crisis, hoping to avoid a further exacerbation of conditions in the country. And I think that that's one of the best hopes we have, that Mexico has returned under Andrés Manuel López Obrador to its traditional policy of the Estrada Doctrine, where they in fact recognize governments as sovereign. They do not interfere in the internal affairs of other governments, and they seek peaceful solutions to any potential conflicts.
What role is the OAS playing in all of this, the Organization of American States? Is this body dominated by those who want regime change in Venezuela now?
Yes, it is to a certain extent. Its Secretary General, Mr. Almagro, has been the strongest proponent for regime change in Venezuela. He was among the first to congratulate Guaido and to say that the OAS would recognize, even though the OAS has not had a meeting to formally decide that. And it was as a result of the inability to sanction Venezuela within the OAS that the conservative members of the organization founded the Group of Lima. These individuals would have rather stayed within the OAS and actually be able to condemn Maduro, sanction Maduro, withdraw support from Maduro from within the OAS. The fact that they were forced out of the OAS and create the Group of Lima speaks to the fact that there wasn't consensus, that the Caribbean nations and several Central American nations opposed efforts to use the OAS the way it had been used against Cuba, to create a blockade and to enforce an embargo. And that was the result of the fact that Venezuela had ample relations with many Central American countries when previously they had a project to provide oil and long-term credits to countries in the Caribbean for whom these prices were extremely onerous.
What about the United Nations? I understand that Maduro is seeking help from the UN. Unfortunately, of course, this is a body that has not been able to have much effect in recent decades, but Maduro is seeking some sort of dialogue through the United Nations?
The General Secretary of the OAS has said that he favors dialogue and negotiations, has repeated that several times. The U.S. is insisting that the Security Council take up the issue of Venezuela. So it remains to be seen what will actually happen in the context of the U.N.
Now, could the opposition under Guaido have overplayed their hand? Because when you said that there were mass protests leading up to this declaration by Guaido to make himself president, that many of the protesters were for a process to restore democratic rule in Venezuela, to address corruption, to address Maduro's failings through a proper process. Could Guaido have overplayed his hand?
I think they might have overplayed their hand. This was very much of an organized, orchestrated campaign. And what this allows Maduro to do is to say, look, I've been saying that there's a coup underway. Here's the evidence. Mm. The evidence is that, like they did during the Bay of Pigs invasion, the idea is to land troops, then bring in a government in exile, establish a government in exile, and that government in arms can then ask for U.S. support. The U.S. would land Marines and secure a beachhead from which that government can rule. They're doing it a bit differently, but the process seems very similar. That is, to create a government in arms or a government in uprising, declare itself in uprising, ask for U.S. support, ask for access to Venezuelan money that is being held as a result of the sanctions abroad, providing them funds, and then create an alternative body within Venezuela. But this is going to allow Maduro to say, we need to close ranks. We need to circle the wagons. We're being attacked. Everything we're offering in terms of reform is under siege. And that's precisely what Maduro was doing on Wednesday and has continued to do on the 24th. So in that context, I think that they may have overplayed their hand.
Now, we might not have, we might not be talking about the fact that the U.S. Could actually offer military support to the opposition. But under Trump, of course, anything is possible with war hawks like John Bolton in his government and Trump's extreme unpredictability and disregard for consequences. Is it possible for the U.S. to invade Venezuela?
One would hope that that would never happen. Mm-hmm. The pain, the suffering, the bloodshed that would happen would Venezuela would bear a heavy cost, and it would polarize the country forever. The consequences of this could be looked when we look at El Salvador, when we look at Guatemala, when we look at countries in which these civil wars have played out. That's the last thing we want in the case of Venezuela. I think that the inability to recognize the other, the ability not to recognize the humanity of the other, and to look for nonviolent means to resolve these contradictions is a troubling trend one sees. And as you know, this idea of brinksmanship and the idea that we can simply outmaneuver each other really sacrifices the very nation that's in play. But again, as you said, Trump and with his government stoppage, may need a distraction. And unfortunately, Venezuela may provide him with that kind of distraction. One, again, would hope not. One would hope that Mexico and Uruguay can put forth a plan, a proposal, along with the Vatican, to seek dialogue, to seek negotiations, so that this would not escalate any further than it is now.
Well, we shall see what happens and how things play out. Miguel, always a pleasure to have you on and enjoy your insight into the situation in Venezuela. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Miguel Tinker Salas. He's a professor of Latin American history and Chicano-Chicana Latino-Latina studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He's written several books, including about Venezuela. The Enduring Legacy is one of them, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela. And Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. He also co-edited Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. We're discussing the ongoing, very tense situation in Venezuela. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes and also our video channel on Vimeo.